turn it on and make sure the numbers are moving, and they are. And then I'm gonna say, today is April 2nd, 2017. I'm Mary Manning with the University of Houston. I'm working on a research project called Community Practice, Identity Building, and the Gulf Coast Sound. I am at Bohemio's with Isaac Rodriguez, who is a DJ and also a bass player.
Yeah.
You have kindly agreed to share your knowledge and experience about DJing. So let's ask the first question. Describe your first music memory of hearing music.
All right. Well, that's a good question. My first, I'm about to be 38, so I was born in 79. My first memories of music were pretty much the first lineup of the MTV videos. You know what I mean? Like from like 82, 83, all those videos. Every time I hear one of those songs, it takes me. And I was probably 3 or 4 years old, maybe 4 years old. And yeah, that first class of videos, that's like my first memory of music, like just all the songs that they would play back then. Those videos, those were my first memories of music. It's you know, like the Beat It video and the Video Killed the Radio Star, like all those. I can remember being a kid and watching them and just sitting in front of MTV and just watching it. And that was like it, you know what I mean? I had an older brother and sister, and I guess when MTV came out, it was a big deal. So 120 Minutes, the show on MTV, all those were like my introduction into music. Like, it wasn't the radio, it wasn't me like hearing family members play acoustic guitar or anything. It was pretty much MTV. That's what it was. So,
do you remember any other groups that you heard while you were listening?
It was just basically whatever they were playing at that time. It was Beat It. It was I'm probably forgetting because I'm getting interviewed, but every time I hear these songs, Duran Duran, The Cure, and what else was it? David Bowie, all that. That first, I guess, class of MTV videos, you know, was pretty much it. Every time I hear it, it takes me back to being a kid. And I mean, I was probably 4 years old. I mean, I got to guess, I got to see what exact date that year that was when it came out, but it was probably like, you know, I remember the commercials saying, you know, broadcasting MTV, you know, for the first time. It was like a shuttle taking off. And that was my first introduction to music, really.
Describe how the music was part of your family or community.
Okay. So, music that was part of my family was, my dad was in a band. But by the time, I didn't grow up with my dad, but I would always hear stories about my dad being in a band. He played in a garage band. And that's how my mother and father met. My mother's older brother was in a garage band, and they were practicing at my mom's parents' house in Fifth Ward. And my dad says it. He told me the story. He said, we were jamming out in the garage, and some little girl walks in the garage, and she's looking all flirty, and she doesn't want to leave, and her brother's trying to kick her out, and you know, that was my mom, you know. my dad's like 3 years older than my mom or something. But so I would always hear stories, and my uncle passed away too. My uncle passed away in the 80s, so I would always hear stories of my uncle and my dad jamming together, but more so my uncle, because I think my dad just jammed as a garage band. He never like moved forward with it. My uncle was like he was a musician. He had a job, but you know, musician was also another source of an income, and he played drums for Archie Bell, and it was probably like one-offs here and there, but you know, he was more serious about it. So that's always been the story in my family. And also Archie Bell has been like a big part of my family, because ever since I can remember, you know, when the family would get together, and my aunts and uncles would get together, like, it wasn't nothing else but Archie Bell that would come on. You know, Archie Bell was the first thing that they would play, and they would all, because they're from the Fifth Ward, so they would all tell stories about Archie, and you know, they would all do the Tighten Up. So that's been a huge part of my family's musical story, you know, just, and then once they started playing Archie, they would start talking about my uncle, who, you know, that was like the highlight of his career, I guess, you know, playing drums for Archie Bell, and like, and you know, that, it, I can imagine that what was fun, you know, back, it's probably in the 70s that he did that, but yeah, so that's pretty much where it goes with my family. My dad played in a garage band with my uncle, and my older brothers and sisters, they were all huge music fans of music, and that's where they introduced me to music, you know, before I had a chance to, you know, I said the MTV thing, but once I got around to actually, you know, getting old enough to like music, that I, you know, to hear music and like it by my own judgment, first music I was introduced to was punk. So that was, I didn't have a chance, you know, like, my brother was punk, my sister was punk, it wasn't the radio, it wasn't, you know, he would listen to hip-hop too, but when I got dragged to my first show when I was like 11 years old, and I mean, I'm 37, about to be 38 this month, and you know, people talk about the old Axiom days and stuff like that, and like, I would have missed that because I was young, I was 12, 11 years old, but luckily I had an older brother, they took me there, you know, so whenever these people that are 10 years older than me talk about it, like, they get surprised, like, what do you know, you didn't go, you know, you're too young, but really, I did go. I seen Sprawl play there plenty of times, which were my favorite, they were, like, my first favorite band, Sprawl, like, in the early 90s when I was, like, 12 or 13, I seen them play there, I seen a play they did called Jesus Christ Superstar, I went to the Vatican, I seen so many shows there, and I was probably seriously like the youngest kid there because of my older brother and sister. Like, they would both drag me, they would take me with them, you know. I remember the first show they took me to, I was just playing outside in the front yard, and I was probably 11 years old, maybe 12, and my brothers and sisters were leaving, and I was like, where y'all going? They're like, you want to come? And I was like, yeah. They're like, go ask mom. And my mom was like, yeah, go ahead, take them. So they took me to shows, and that was like it. I mean, I was 11, 12 years old. I mean, they would take care of me, of course, you know. My brothers and sisters, they didn't go to, you know, a lot of people would go and drink and smoke or do whatever and hang out, like, they went specifically for the music. So as soon as the band started, we'd all be dancing and stuff like that, but everybody would like take care of me because I was the youngest kid. Even people I didn't know, like, if people were dancing too crazy in front of me, they would like grab me and pull me over to the side. Like, that's what I remember like the most. And so my family had a big influence on my where I'm at now, you know, playing music and DJing. So I think that's about it that I can say about my family.
What about places outside of bars? Did you like do any music in school, or were there?
I never did music in school. Like, I was always just a fan of music. Like, even when I started playing in a band, like, it wasn't supposed to happen. You know, I was never a bass player. I never knew how to, when pretty much when I joined the band, they gave me a bass, so we all had to learn together. But yeah, I was never into any kind of there was never like no one else in my family who did music. I never touched any instruments, I never sang or anything like that. It was just I was always just a fan of music. There was nobody else in my family who was a musician beside my uncle, who passed away when I was very young, and my dad, who wasn't really a part of my life until later on. So yeah, we were all just fans of music. That's it.
When did you start playing music?
I actually started playing music kind of late. I started playing music in my mid-20s. I mean, most people pick up a guitar or their instrument when they're a teenager. Me, I didn't pick it up till I was in my mid-20s. Like, I had a friend, he was starting up a band. Well, you know, he's one of those guys where I'm getting a band going. Really, he didn't have a band. It was his dream to start up a band. And he was just getting into music. And I could tell he was, you know, he was, like, thirsty for knowledge of music. And this was before, I mean, it wasn't before the internet, but the internet, it wasn't as common to go to Google and just Google something. You know, it's like the late 90s, early 2000s. So, I mean, me, you know, knowing more or less what he was trying to go as far as his music, I started turning him on to bands and giving him CDs and tapes. And one day he got a job at a Guitar Center or something like that, and he came over to my house one day after work with a bass and a bass amp. And he was like, here. And I was like, what are you talking about? He was like, what's this? He was like, it's for you. He's like, learn how to play it so you can jam with me. And I was like, oh, really? He's like, yeah. So I took it to my room, and it took me a while just to know how to pluck it, learn how to pluck it and hold it and stuff. And after a few months, like, we started actually sounding kind of like a band. And then about a year or two, we got to the point to where we made music and it didn't suck. Well, I guess it did, but people were surprised that we taught ourselves and we, you know, it was groovy or whatever. They could dance to it, because the music we started playing was like more like ska and punk. And, you know, everyone was like, wow, you guys are actually, you know, you taught yourselves. And so, you know, with that, we went and played our first show, and I guess the rest is history. I played music in bands for like, it didn't last long, like 10 years. And then a few years ago, I kind of just quit all the bands I was in and just started focusing on my family and DJing, because it was getting kind of hectic with my job, my band, my family, and with DJing. So it was, I had to cut one off. And I think the easiest one to cut off was being in a band. It's kind of like being in a whole nother relationship with, you know, 3 different personalities, 5 different personalities. And I mean, as much as I loved it, it was just the easier way out, like as far as just, you know, with the easiest one to let go, because DJing, I could do that by myself. You know, I have my family and my job, which I can't let go. And so about 3 years ago, yeah, I played my last show with this band that I was in called Fusca, and we made some noise, and they're still together, but we made noise. We got like interest from the Smelvis Records from LA, the guy who plays guitar for Tim, what's that, Tim Armstrong's band, not Rancid, but he's got another band, but he plays guitar for them, and he's got his own record label, and he kept like hitting me up, trying to get us to send him more music and stuff, because he came to Houston and played with us. But we had, you know, we did everything like I kind of set out to. Like, when I started up a band, we started up to have fun and just play the shows that we wanted to go to, that now we don't have to pay to get in them, you know. And we played the 30-foot fall Christmas show, and we toured and all that, and that's kind of all I wanted to get out of it, you know, and I felt like I did, so, you know, that was it with that.
Could you give me a timeline of the first band you played?
The first band I played in was called Always Guilty. I played in that band from like 2000 to 2007, but not the whole time wasn't playing shows, actually. You know, 2000 is when he gave me the bass, and I had to learn how to play it. So that took a year or two before we actually stepped out of the garage and, you know, played our first show. So I'd say from 2000 to 2007, it was Always Guilty. And then 2007 to 2000, I'd say 2013, I started up this band called Fusca. And with Fusca, like, I did everything. Like, we did everything really fast. Like, we put out albums, we toured, we had a really good fan base right off the back, because people knew me from Always Guilty, and also the other guys that I had recruited to be in the band with me, they were in pretty well-known bands around the city. So it was the best part of, I mean, I learned everything with Always Guilty. You know, you learn how to play, you know, play shows and negotiate, and you know what and what not to do. And then with Fusca, I kind of took everything I learned from Always Guilty and did Fusca the right way. And then so from 2013 to 2014, so I left Fusca in 2013, and then I joined the Scatastrophics in 2014, and I only stayed in the Scatastrophics for about a year. And the Scatastrophics were started up by the guy who I first started playing with in Always Guilty. So that's why I joined that band, because he seen that I wasn't in Fusca no more. So he's like, man, come, let's jam again. You know, it's been a long time, and we started off together. So I start jamming with them. But, you know, I left Fusca because of the whole, you know, I didn't have enough time. And I kind of got talked into jamming in the Scatastrophics, which I enjoyed it and I wanted to. But I realized, you know, while I was in the Scatastrophics, that it wasn't going to work out. So I left them too, and that was it. So that was like 3 years ago, as far as me being in a band and playing music.
Can you tell me more about learning to play your instrument?
And well, learning...
What influenced you, your style, and how you learned?
Honestly, I just learned by... I was in the room. I learned... I'm self-taught all the way. Like, I never sat down with anyone, and they showed me, like, all right, this is A, B, D, or whatever. I just learned how to play by myself. I asked questions, you know, to people who I knew played bass. You know, how would you hold it? How do you pluck it? You know, what fingers are best to use? And, you know, started playing by ear. You know, like, if something sound right, you know, it sounds right, you know. And this guy who was a really good guitar player joined Always Guilty, and then he told me, like, yeah, you're doing a good job, you know, just, you taught yourself, you know, that's great, and what you're doing is right. But, you know, he kind of showed me, like, the scales and everything like that. Like, I was playing scales, I just didn't know I was playing them, you know. And he's like, yeah, you're playing a minor scale, that's a minor scale, that's a major scale. But, yeah, I mean, he is the one who, like, told me what, like, I was doing it already, I was doing the job, but he told me what I was doing. So, yeah, that's how I learned how to play the bass.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I want to kind of go back to when you were talking about your friend.
Yeah.
Who bought the bass for you.
Yeah.
And before that...
He didn't buy it.
Oh, and
he didn't buy it. He took it from his job.
Oh, okay. Okay. I thought, wow, that was generous.
No. That's funny because he took it, and a week later he had to come get it back. and then after, yeah, and then after that he bought me one after that. So yeah, I guess he is generous. But anyway.
One thing that interested me that you said was that when you met him, he was interested in music, and you already knew about music because
yeah.
you were listening to music,
yeah.
and you shared the music with him. Can
yeah.
you talk to me about, like, because that seems like kind of relevant to DJing in a way, you
yeah,
know,
yeah.
like this idea of listening and being a fan and playing and sharing.
Yeah. So he's like 3 years younger than me, and not everyone was lucky enough to have an older brother and sister that took them to shows, you know what I mean? So I learned a lot at a young age, you know, like I've seen bands like Bad Brains, which were one of his influences. So I started telling him, you know, hey, check out, HR's got solo stuff, you know. He started his own band, you know, back in the day. So, you know, he didn't really know about that kind of stuff. You know, he just might have heard of Bad Brains, but he didn't know that HR had his totally own band, you know, and they have good music, and I had the music, and I was like, here, check it out. And so I turned him on to, he was, like I said, he was doing the ska reggae thing, so I turned him on to a bunch of other bands that he had never heard of, because I think, like, UB40 was his influence. But I start telling him about Lee Scratch Perry and the Scatolites, and about a Studio One record label and everything, and I just kind of start teaching him everything that I had learned from going to shows and from being around older people that taught me, you know what I mean? And like I said, this guy was from the suburbs, you know, he just heard music, might have seen a video on MTV or heard a song on the radio that was like, oh, that's cool, you know? But he wasn't really aware of everything that he didn't know the history or the culture of the music that he was trying to play, and he didn't know really much about it besides what he had heard on the radio or seen on MTV, you know. So then I start, you know, telling him the history of the music, like the history of Jamaican, like ska, yeah, you hear ska punk, but it's really, ska is Jamaican, you know, it's from Jamaica, you know. So I start telling him about that and stuff, and he started getting more into the Jamaican stuff, and it is kind of like DJing. Like, that's another reason why I started DJing, because I was always turning people on to stuff that you know, they had never heard of before, you know. So that's pretty much how it went with that. So I pretty much told him how it was with Jamaican ska, but by the time I finished with him, he knew everything, you know. What was Jamaican ska, what was two-tone from the UK, what was, you know, you could hear, you know, what's from the US, and he knew all that by the time we had started up the band. So we kind of helped each other out, you know. I kind of taught him about music, and he was like my he was like my support system as far as like playing the bass and someone saying, man, you suck, you know, because he would be like, nah, dude, it's good, man, you're sounding cool, you know, don't worry about it, you're learning and it's cool. So I guess we kind of helped each other out.
You mentioned learning from your brothers and sisters, mm-hmm. and going to shows and MTV. Were there any other ways you were discovering music?
That was pretty much it. I mean, I would just have to be home and go to my brother's room, and he would get a new cassette or something, and I would, you know, obviously he was older than me, so he's 8 years older than me, so the weekends I would be, when I wasn't going to shows with him, or when he wasn't going to shows, I'd be home just playing his cassettes out. I think the first cassette I knew front to back was Agnostic Front, Victim in Pain. That was like, I was like young as heck, and I knew that cassette front to back. It's kind of funny. But yeah, this is like, I didn't have to go anywhere outside my house for music. And my sister was a huge fan of like New Wave and the Smiths and stuff. So I'm a huge Smiths fan, and I got that from her. Like, I mean, most Chicanos are really into the Smiths. Like, a lot of people don't realize that. But like, there's like guys that are like all like cholos, and they're like, they love this. They have like a Morrissey tattoos on them and stuff like that. Really, that's like a whole nother story.
That's a really interesting story.
Yeah, there's like videos about it, like East LA, like, and the Smiths, like, they like go hand in hand. Like, they show like these cholos with like tattoos. I know a cholo with the Smiths tattoo on him, and he's got a Joy Division tattoo on him. Love Will Tear Us Apart Again, and he's like straight up. If you seen him like in his lowrider car, you would not assume that that's what he was listening to. But I think it's just kind of weird, you know. But anyway.
Do you have any idea why that might be?
I don't know. I think it's because we're like real passionate people, and the music, the Smiths music, is about like, you know, heartbreak, and I don't know. I mean, it's just real heavy. Like the band Girl in the Coma, like, they're San Antonio, Chicanos from San Antonio, and they're influenced by the Smiths, like 100%. You know, like, if you talk to them, like, they give all props to Morrissey and the Smiths, you know, like, that's who they named their band after one of the songs, you know. And it's just, I don't know, I mean, that's how it always been. But yeah, you can like Google that, like, why do Mexicans love the Smiths, or Mexicans love Morrissey, and there's like a bunch of videos that come up about it. And it's just, I mean, she's singing about love, and Mexicans are, you know, we're all about our relationships with our women and vice versa, you know. I don't know, but it's just that, also that band right there has been a heavy influence on my family and bonding moments we jam in the Smiths, you know. And it's just something, I don't know, I guess like people think it's, people out on the outside, it's always been natural to us, you know what I mean. People, you know, wouldn't expect it, but to us, you know, it's just been something that we did. We jammed the Smiths, and a lot of people don't think that Chicanos are really into Smiths, but we are. So,
when did you start DJing?
Okay, I started DJing, I've been DJing probably 10 years. I mean, I guess I'm still rookie compared to a lot of the guys I know. And I started DJing, I'd say, maybe sooner. I'd say 2006, so a little over 10 years I started DJing. And the reason why was because, you know, my band had just started playing shows. We would start playing at venues, and I would notice, like, we were a ska band, and we, you know, or ska punk band or whatever. And, you know, usually when you go play at a venue, it's just up to the sound guy to throw on whatever he wants to throw on, you know. Like, if he's into metal, he's going to throw on metal. If he's into, like, grunge, he's going to throw on grunge or whatever. So I would notice, like, I would get my people, the people would start coming to the shows, and they'd be like, man, you know, like, I mean, I can listen to anything, you know. It doesn't affect me. I'm not one of those people who's going to be like, man, what's going on? What's this playing, you know? But I noticed the people, like, say the DJ would play a certain genre of music, and the people would, I could tell that they wanted to get warmed up for the show, and the music that the DJ was playing didn't necessarily go with what we were playing, and I knew that's what would get these people warmed up and ready for us to come on. So I started making mix CDs and bringing them to the shows of like ska and punk and ska punk, and I noticed every time like I'd put the CD on before we played, and like every time a song would come on, like a like say One Step Beyond for Madness, people would start reacting and dancing and stuff like that. So I was like, wow, like if I played that like at a certain time of night, I'm sure it could get these guys going. So from CDs, I went on to bringing my because I got to rewind a little bit. Is that cool? Good. Okay. So I started bringing my turntables to the shows, and I was like, man, you know what? I'm not gonna bring a mixed CD no more. I'm gonna bring my turntables, and I'm gonna DJ. I'm gonna play my records that I want these people to, that I think these people should hear. And I can not only could I play them and turn them on to the music, but I could play it at the right time. So like, you know, say people start getting there early, and a good song comes on, they're not gonna react to it as they would if I played it while. I guess after they had a buzz, you know what I mean? And they wanted to hear, you know, if I played it early, they were just going to, you know, they might have like bobbed their head to it or something. But if I play it later on in the night, then I can really get them going. And if I can rewind, the reason why I had my turntables is because in the late 90s, I mean, I've always been into punk and everything, but I was also, I mean, I'm from Houston, so I couldn't help but being into like screw music. So I'm buying screw tapes. You get influenced by DJ Screw, right? So you go out and you buy you some turntables, and you just learn how to do all the stuff he was doing. So I had these turntables, but I never had ever thought of DJing with them. Like, I just wanted to like make mixtapes and stuff like that, but I never got around to doing it. I just bought the turntables, and I taught myself how to DJ scratch and how to chop and everything, but I never got into to making mixtapes or DJing. It was actually when I started playing bass, that's when I put the turntables away and just start focusing on making music. So then once I started playing in a band and started, you know, bringing those mix CDs to the shows, and then realizing that I could just bring my own turntables and DJ my own shows, you know, during intermission or before, or even after, like, you know, sometimes we would finish playing and people wouldn't want to leave, so that would be perfect time for me to DJ, you know, some more tunes. So that's what got me into DJing, just basically wanting to just, I guess, make my shows better and just DJ during intermission and making sure the right music was played at my shows that I wanted people to hear and that I pretty much knew that they wanted to hear, you know. So that's what it was, like, you know.
How has the style of music that you've DJed changed over time, or has it?
Okay, yeah, it actually has. it's changed big time, actually. So when I first started DJing, like I said, I was playing all Jamaican stuff, ska and reggae and stuff from the UK and you know, punk. That's what I was playing most of the time. Probably the first 7 years of me DJing, I was focusing on all that ska and punk and reggae. That's what it was all about. It wasn't until my grandma, she lives in LA, and she comes to visit once maybe every 5 years. She's lived there my whole life. I've never known her. She's never lived in Houston for my whole life. So she comes this last time 3 years ago, and every time she comes, I pick her up and take her out to eat. Well, this last time she came 3 years ago, probably four now, she comes and stays with her sister, and her sister lives over here on the south side, and so I go to pick her up, and I notice her sister's having a estate sale the next day, like they're getting ready to have an estate sale. So I go in there to pick her up, I give her a hug and say hi, and she's like, hey, you know, your tia's having an estate sale, if you see anything you want, just take it. So I was like, cool. I was like, do you have any records by any chance? And my aunt was like, yeah, I have a box over there. If you want them, take them. So I pull out the box, and I notice it's a bunch of 45s of Texas stuff, like Sonny and the Sunliners, Little Joe and the Latinaires. It's pretty much like all the early Tex-Mex, the early Tejano stuff, but it was their English stuff, because most of the Tejano bands, they all started off playing R&B and soul before they did Tejano. They all started off playing English. And that's basically, I hit the jackpot without even knowing it, you know. I took that box home, and I cleaned up the records because they were all in really bad condition because they had been sitting for years. I took them home, I threw them on, and as soon as I threw them on, like, automatically felt a connection with it, and I automatically knew that I had been missing out, and I automatically knew that I had been neglecting like my own culture, and like I had been not supporting the music that, you know, at the same time, this is my, you know, this is what my mom and my dad and my grandparents listened to, and I had been, you know, totally focused on something else. That by the time I got these records, I think, like, honestly, I think it was meant to be. Like, I think, like, someone told me, like, whoa, Isaac, like, what are you doing? Like, you need to help us preserve this music. Because in Houston, a lot of the bands I spin are from Houston, and they did so much work in the 60s, and nobody knows about them. Like, that kind of stuff got swept under the rug. So basically, I inherited my aunt's collection of Tex-Mex 45s, and 90% of it was bands from Houston that I had heard the names, and you know, I hear my grandparents talking about these bands that they would go see, and my mom and dad talking about that they go see, but I never stopped to I was too busy, you know, trying to be a kid and explore music, you know. I mean, sometimes you don't really focus on what's in the house. Like, what are they listening to? You know, you hear them talk about the bands, and I would love to hear the stories, but it never hit me to, like, start researching these bands, you know, that they were talking about until I got that record collection. And once I got that record collection from my aunt, like, I pretty much made, like, if I was going left, like, I made a right turn, and that's pretty much, I'd say that was, like, 3 years ago, almost four, and that's pretty much the direction I've been going in ever since. Like, I pretty much slowly started, you know, playing less ska when I would DJ and less of what I was doing before, and I'd start throwing this more into the mix until it got to the point to where this Tex-Mex stuff is all I did, and you know, it's all I'm passionate about right now, and that's what I'm doing, and for me it's kind of weird because like I kind of built up a crowd with what I was doing before, and now that I got into this Tex-Mex stuff, I'm like starting all over, you know. Like if I did the ska, like I could DJ to a full house, you know, people know me, they'll come out, and that's what they want to hear, and that's what they know me as. But I kind of had to like start all over when I got into Tex-Mex, because I mean, the average person, if you're into ska or punk, you're not going to be into Tex-Mex, you know. I mean, that's just what I've learned throughout the years, you know. Like people want to hear what they want to hear, you know. They want to go out, they want to hear punk, they want to hear ska, they want to hear soul, but like a lot of people don't want to really give this stuff a chance. And there's a lot of people who do, but at the same time, like, that's my job to, I feel that's my duty to turn them on and say, whoa, but hold on, like, you think these bands are just like your average Tejano bands from like the 90s and 80s when it was when it reached its peak. Like, these bands did everything DIY, they recorded themselves, they released their music on independent record labels, like they sang all their first records were English, you know. It wasn't until later that they all started singing Spanish. So like, you know, you give these guys a chance, you know, check them out. And usually when people do take the time out to do it, they do realize like, wow, this stuff is great, you know what I mean. So that's pretty much where I'm at right now. Like, that's like, I feel like that's my duty and my job to, because also when I stopped playing in bands and I wanted to hear this stuff, like when I found the records and I started collecting them more, the Tex-Mex records, I started looking around like, where is this stuff being played, you know, because I want to go listen to it, you know, I want to learn more about it. But looking around, I realized there was nowhere else it was getting played, you know. There's a million Tejano clubs in Houston, little Tejano bars around town, but they all focus on the stuff from the 90s, like Selena and Mas and all the stuff when it reached its peak and it was huge. Like, nobody goes into the early 70s, into the 60s where it all started, and the late 50s. So that's what I wanted to hear, you know, the roots of it. And that's when I felt like I had a strong enough record collection to start playing bars and to start introducing this to everybody. And I started scouting out places where I thought it would work, because I didn't want to do it at like your typical Tejano club, because I don't think those people would enjoy it, actually. Like I didn't think they would get it, because they're, you know, they're older and they want to, I mean, they're not, they just want to go drink and they want to hear the hits, you know. They want to hear the hits and the stuff I spin. I spin some of the hits, but most of it's stuff. It's like a band that released 145 and they broke up, you know, but they were a band from Houston that, you know, they did their thing. And that's the stuff I focus on more, kind of the rare, but at the same time I spin the hits too, but I spin a lot of the rare stuff. So it had to be the right place. Like, I knew it had to be a place where the people were had an open mind. And I'd known Nick for years, and we're kind of acquaintances. So I went to the DNW, and I seen that Nick was booking there. And one thing about Nick, I would always see him at, like, Skarnales shows when he was in Skarnales, and I'd see him at shows, you know, here and there. But I would also, he was the only guy from that scene that I would always see at the Tejano concerts. Like, he was the only guy. So I knew that me and him kind of had the same background and upbringing. Like, you know, we were open-minded when it comes to, you know, all genres of music. But at the same time, we're like three or four generation Houstonians, and we like, you know, to hear Tejano music, you know, Houston music, Texas music. So I told him about it. I was like, hey, I got an idea, man. Like, I think it'll work here at this place, because, you know, people come here, they see your band, and your band's like a big gumbo of all kind of different styles. And I was like, I think we could make it work here. Where I was like, I got an idea where we should spin, like, you know, Tejano oldies and R&B and soul and swamp pop, because that's all connected. And I think, you know, we give it a shot and see if it works here. And he was like, yeah, man, that's a great idea. And I was like excited, and like a few months passed, like 6 months passed, and I didn't hear from him. So I was like, man, I guess it was just bar talk, you know. And then one day he hit me up. He was like, hey, sorry, I've been really busy, but are you still interested in DJing over here on Sundays? And that's where we started 2 years ago at the DNW. And that's, I mean, even though I DJ here and there, like the DNW is the, I guess that's our home base. And we met Manuel at the DNW. Like, I was spinning his records, and I had no idea he was sitting at the bar. Like, I had a record of his from 1968, and I think Nick told me, he was like, hey, is that Manuel Mendiola in the Exiles? I was like, yeah. He's like, you know, I met him the other day, and he's sitting over there at the bar. And I was like, really? So I went around the DJ booth, and I walked to the bar, and I was like, do you know who, you recognize that? And he was like, yeah, that's me. I was like, oh, wow, man, that's cool. Like, I can't believe you're here. You know, that's great, man. Because one thing about that record I had was, like, I really liked that record, and I couldn't find nothing about them on Google or YouTube. I mean, there was, like, two songs of theirs on YouTube, but nothing to say, like, what happened to him or how his career went or anything like that. There was nothing, no history on the band on Google. So, and I had always liked that record I had. And, you know, I noticed from the record label, it was on Gapoca Records, which was out of Houston, which was one of the Gaston Ponce's record labels. He was a guy from Houston, like Huey Moe. He had tons of record labels, and he was putting out tons of Tex-Mex and Chicano soul and cumbia, like in the 60s. You know, he was kind of like the Mexican version of Huey Moe. And through Manuel, I learned about him, and I would have never known about him. Like, me and Manuel had a sit down after that, and we start talking and hanging out, and he pretty much schooled me on, like, everything, like Houston, like back then, because he was a pretty big deal back then. Like, they would play at the Pan American Ballroom on North Main, and the place, there would be like 2,000 people there on the weekend, just, you know, just having fun. And I learned everything that I'm all Houston stuff through Manuel, and then later on through Gus. But so that's, you know, once, back to what you asked, has my music changed? Yes. Once I got that record collection, like, I instantly felt a connection with it, and I instantly, like, fell in love with it. And just as every day, the passion for it and to learn about it grew more and more every day. Like, and it's Houston. It's just that these bands are just as Houston as DJ Screw. They're just as Houston as Archie Bell. You know, they did as much work as anybody else, but for some reason, there's been nobody but Gus Garza to try to keep it going. And Gus Garza, he doesn't really have a connection with the younger crowd. So when I met Gus Garza, that's where me and him kind of bonded, because he's like, man, my whole DJ career, I've been DJing since, I've had Bailando en Tejas going since 1968. Nobody has ever asked me about the history of the music here in Houston. I mean, no other DJ, I take that back. People have wanted to interview him, but he said no other DJ has shown interest in, like, the history of the music from Houston, of the record labels, of the Pan American, of his story. He's like, no other DJ has asked that. And to meet you and to see that you're thirsty for what you like, you know, you want to pick my brain apart. Like, he's like, I'm here for you, And that was just another, I felt like that was just another, I guess, tool to help me out on my path to learning more so I can spread as much info about this music that I can. And me and Gus are really good friends now. Like, and it's just, I feel like I'm just constantly learning and still on my path to where I need to be as far as DJing. And when you DJ, like, not only are you DJing, but you kind of become a music historian, you know. You start learning about these labels and about these musicians, and you know, and you become a historian. Like, you're thirsty for all the stories and the knowledge. And it's not just about making people dance. Like, you know, you hire a DJ to get your party going or to get your bar going or whatever, but on that other end, it's like there's a whole story to these artists and labels that needs to be preserved. And to my surprise, like, it really hasn't been preserved the way it should be here in Houston. Like, Houston was home to probably one of the biggest Chicano soul labels, which was Huey Moe's Teardrop record label. Like, they released like hits and probably more hits than any other label from East LA or from San Antonio. They have, San Antonio is like the mecca of Chicano soul and Tejano. Like, I give San Antonio their props, but I think Huey Moe took Chicano soul further than anybody else has ever taken it before, when he took Sonny and the Sunliners on American Bandstand with Dick Clark. Like, he picked, Sonny was from San Antonio, he picked that record up from San Antonio, he brought Sonny to Houston, and he got Sonny a band here, and he put Sonny a band together here in Houston, and he took that band and Sonny to American Bandstand. And I don't think any other Chicano soul or Tejano band has ever gone that far. And you know, although Huey was from Louisiana, he was based out of Houston. That's where he set up shop. And Freddie Fender, look how big Freddie Fender is. Like, that's a product of Houston. Like, that's Huey Moe right there. So Houston plays a big role in the music that a lot of people, you know, when you hear Chicano soul, you think of L.A. When you hear Tejano, you think of San Antonio. No one ever thinks of Houston, you know. And like I said, Houston plays a big role, and somehow it's not really been, you know, it's not had its proper say in the books, you know. There's a book called Chicano Soul, and they go through the whole story of it, and there's like a 2-page thing on Houston, how, you know, which did not give it its justice, you know. So I felt like, and there's a lot of wrongs, they didn't print the most accurate stuff. So, you know, learning this from the guys who actually lived it, you know, I wouldn't have never known. I would have read the book and thought that was accurate and that was right. But, you know, meeting the guys who played with Sonny and Gus Garza and the Sunliners, I mean, you hear the right stories, you know. Yeah. And that's just where I'm at with it, you know. I'm passionate about it. This, like I said, this is the music. I'm a fifth generation Houstonian. This is the music of my family, and this is what my parents got married at the Pan American Ballroom, which is where all this took place. So it's just this is, I'm pretty much focused on now.
Could you talk a little bit about what music you might play with the Tejas Got Soul?
All right, Tejas Got Soul is pretty much, so me and Nick started DJing, and we didn't have a name for ourselves yet, and we were calling the night we were calling it Noches en el Barrio, just like nights in the neighborhood. We didn't have a night for it. We didn't have a name for it yet. So I was just, when I was doing ska and reggae, I would do a night called Reggae Got Soul, which is an old song from, I can't think of it right now, and it usually, I mean, everybody knows this song, but it's a song called Reggae Got Soul. So I used to do a night called Reggae Got Soul, and then when I started doing the Tex-Mex stuff, I just kind of switched it over to Tejas Got Soul, because that's exactly what it is. Like, it's Texas soul, like, it's Tejano soul. So what you would hear at a Tejas Got Soul event is Sonny and the Sunliners. They're English and Spanish. Sonny was playing, started off playing R&B, and he started off playing, He started off playing R&B and soul, and he later went to Tex-Mex. So I play his English and his Spanish stuff. I play the Latin airs. He's like probably the first guy to, Little Joe and the Latin airs, the first to start playing Chicano soul and R&B and Tex-Mex. And I play the Starduster's, which were from Houston. So if you go to if you come to a Tejas Got Soul event, you're gonna hear. I try to keep it mostly Houston stuff, but I mean obviously I can't keep it all Houston, and so basically you're more or less gonna hear Texas stuff. I play Chicano soul and R&B from San Antonio, from Houston, from the Valley, from McAllen, from Austin, from El Paso, and I also play not only Tex-Mex, but I play the other soul, like Archie Bell and the Masters of Soul, the Masters of Houston, and the TSU Tornadoes. I play this stuff too, but my main focus is to play the Tex-Mex stuff. I mean, and the reason why is because I feel like it's not, it's been swept under the rug and people need to hear about it. I'm not playing it just like to show favor or anything or because I don't like the other stuff. I'm playing it like to draw awareness and to turn people on to it, you know, because not enough people are paying this music any the right attention that it deserves. So basically you're going to hear bands like the Starduster's from Houston. You're going to hear Little Jesse and the Rockin' V's from Houston. You're going to hear Big Louie, Los Muchachos from Houston. And all these bands were like from around this area. So, and from San Antonio, you'll hear the Royal Gestures, Little Joe and the Latin Airs, Dimas Garza. And these are all names that are, and these guys are, I mean, like legends in this music. And like I said, for some reason, they've just kind of been forgotten in this city. So, Tejas Got Soul, you're pretty much going to hear Tejas Soul, Tejano Soul, and Chicano Soul. That's what you'd hear.
I'm curious. Did you grow up speaking Spanish?
No, I don't actually speak very much Spanish. Yeah, like I said, I mean, I'm a... my family's been in Houston for generations, and the oldest relative I can remember was my great grandmother, who she was also born in Houston, and she passed away in 98, and she was 95 years old, and she spoke perfect English, but she also spoke Spanish. So I never had that older relative that didn't speak English, so I had to speak Spanish to them. Like on both my mom and my dad's side were from Houston, like for generations. My dad's side was from Second Ward and the Alaclan neighborhood, and my mom's side was from First Ward over there by the courthouse. So I don't know any family. I mean, although I don't know any family, like it's been all Houston. So there's never the need, I guess, to talk to me in Spanish. So, yeah.
Would you describe to me a typical DJ experience? What does the room look like? And there might be different types too. Yeah. Maybe like at the.
Let's just say the D&W. So the D&W, we go to the D&W on Sundays. I get there at it starts at 6. I get there at like 5:20 to start setting up. You go in there and there's a table set up for us, and there's people drinking and. You know, they're having a good time and they're hanging out. So we go in there. They usually ask me as soon as I walk in for requests. Me and Nick actually have a bet going, like who's gotten the fastest request. And like one time I just pulled up and the guy came to the car and was like, man, I want to hear some of this. I was like, dude, let me get out of the car first. But anyway, so you go in there, it's people drinking and there's lights and, you know, the mood is definitely set, you know. And you set up and, you know, you get the music going and people start coming up to you and just telling you, oh, I remember that song, or, oh, wow, I haven't heard that in years, or, oh, man, you guys are actually spinning records. Wow, I haven't seen that in forever. So, yeah, I mean, the drinks are flowing and the vibe is going and the music's pumping. And I mean, not every night is a blast. I mean, some nights are slow, some nights are great, you know, just... It just, I guess, just, you know, varies some different, if there's something else going on that day, or, you know, sometimes, surprisingly, there's like a full house, you know, but, you know, that's on our Sunday things, and you know, we're there every last Sunday of the month, so it's just like, yeah, people expect us to be there. So sometimes they're there, and sometimes they're having a blast, or sometimes there's very few people there. But every time we do it on a Friday or Saturday, it's totally different. You know, the dance floor's packed all the time, and, you know, it's a Friday and Saturday, you know. And, yeah, I mean, my favorite place to spin is right there at the DNW, you know, where unless it's at the Continental and we have a big event going on or something like that. But
tell me a little bit more about what type of events that might be going on at the Continental Club.
All right, so the Continental Club, we've had this thing called Tejas Roots, and it's pretty much a showcase of, you know, Nick's band plays, and I DJ, and Robert plays, and last year we actually brought in an extra special guest. We found one of the old guys from Houston who was Manuel Mendiola from the Exiles, and he had been retired from music for like 20-30 years, so we convinced him, you know, into playing another set, one last show, and it took him some talking, but he agreed to do it. So we had the show at the Continental, and basically it was just kind of a showcase of Tex-Mex from the past and the present. With we had Manuel, you know, who represented the past, and Nick Gaitan, who was representing the future of Tex-Mex and the present, you know. And then you had me in there playing my records of, you know, just kind of playing the older stuff so that people can know, you know, where the music came from. And we had tons of people out. It was a full house, and people really seemed to have a great time. They were dancing, and the show went well. We're actually going to do another one this year. And there's some guys that we're talking to about coming back from retirement and playing the show. And also, I'm going to be spinning at this... I guess in memory of Selena event this Saturday coming up, and it's another Tex-Mex thing, you know. Basically anything I'm involved in is probably going to be Tex-Mex from now on.
Is there a difference between what you play and what Nick plays, and how are they the same and how are they different?
As far as DJing or? Mm-hmm. No, me and Nick pretty much play the same thing. Like, well... Okay, so we both focus on Tex-Mex, but Nick, he goes more into Louisiana, like with the swamp pop. Like, I play swamp pop too, but Nick is the real reason why we play swamp pop. Like, that's a big influence on his sound. And so I guess the main thing that would be different is I focus more on Texas, and Nick goes more into Louisiana. So that's pretty much the only difference.
You've talked about this a little bit, but I'm going to ask you to expand on what playing the Tex-Mex music means to you personally.
Okay, so playing the Tex-Mex music, it means it basically means everything to me. Like I said, I'm a you know, my family is deeply rooted in this city, and after I left my band and it came time for me to look around and, you know, want to go hang out at a bar that played this specific Tex-Mex music from this era, like there was none to be found. So I kind of took it upon myself, and I felt that it was a duty of mine to if there was nobody out there doing it, for me to do it myself. Not only because I enjoy the music, but because I felt like it represents my family, it represents my culture, it represents what I'm about. And, you know, Houston is a melting pot. You know, I can go anywhere, I can hear cumbia. I can go anywhere, I can hear norteño. I can go anywhere, and I can hear Zydeco. I can hear Jim Ska. But this music that is rooted here in the city, I couldn't find it. So I felt sad that I couldn't find it. And I felt obligated to be the person to go out there and give people, you know, that choice, you know, to if they were looking for it, it's right here. And I'm very passionate about it. This is like I said, this is my family. This is what my family listened to. This is what my grandparents listened to. This, I feel like this is what I'm supposed to be doing now. Like, nobody was doing it in this city. So I felt the need to take it upon myself to do it, as far as preserving the music, you know, playing that music, the music from that certain era that I know I've said it before, but it has been swept under the rug, you know. Like I said, a lot of these bands are from Houston, and it's sad that nobody knows who they are. They played in Houston for years. They released hundreds of records. You know, they played for some great labels. And in what, you know, the 60s was 50 years ago, and they're forgotten. I can name five Houston bands that put out multiple records to a group of people, and none of them will know one of those bands. So, you know, that's why I DJ this music. I spin it. I try to put bands to get reunite bands. I'm on the Rock and Soul Review on Saturdays. I play all this music because as long as I'm here, I can't let this music just fade away. It's too good for me to let it fade away. And not only that, like I said, this is my culture, you know. I can go all around Houston and get other people's culture if I was looking for it, and I felt like mine wasn't represented, so that's why I felt the need to do it.
You mentioned the Rock and Soul event.
The Rock and Soul. No, the Rock and Soul Review.
It's review. Can you tell me more about your role in that?
Okay, so the Rock and Soul Review is it's on KPFT HD radio, and it's on Saturday nights from 6 to 11. And basically, it's a multi-genre radio show. They had a guy doing a soul from 6 to 7, and I guess he couldn't do it. And he was doing basically soul, you know, soul as in like Motown and Northern Soul. And, you know, when you think about soul, you know, you know, James Brown and stuff like that. And so he got too busy and he couldn't do it. So they brought me in, I guess to fill in because he couldn't do it. They brought me in as a guest. And once I got in there, they kind of dug what I was doing and they got it. So they were like, if you want to be a part of the show, you can definitely, you know, you can have this time slot. But at the same time, they also had asked Felipe to do that same hour. And me and Felipe have known each other for years, so we just came to an agreement. We'll just do it every other weekend. So he does one Saturday, I'm off. He's off one Saturday, I'm on. He's off. So we're kind of like going back and forth. And basically, I just play everything that I have in my record collection, the Tejano Soul, the Texas Soul, and the Tex-Mex, which consists of, and when I say Tejas got soul, I'm not necessarily saying soul as in like soul music, like R&B. I'm talking about heart and soul. Like, I'll play the conjuntos, I'll play the rancheras, I'll play the boleros. Like, all this music, like, they put their soul into making it, and that's what I mean. You know, some people think that when they see Tejas got soul, that I spin, you know, just your average, you know, soul music, which you would think of 60s soul music, you know. But what Tejas got soul is it's everything, you know, Texas and Tex-Mex. And the reason why I said soul is because these guys were doing it from their heart and soul. And conjunto is accordion music. It's not soul, but I play it because, I mean, that's what these guys were putting into the music. So that's what you'll hear on the Rock and Soul Review. So that's what I do from 6 to 7. And then it's followed by Biggie's Rockabilly Hour. And, you know, Big E from, he does the Rock Baby events, Rock Baby Rocket, and he has the Big Cats Barbershop. He does 7 to 8, and then Heather Fells does 8 to 9. She does a punk hour. And I don't know the guys from 9 to 10, but they do a hardcore hour. So it's just a multi-genre radio show. And I kind of feel like the odd man out. But they give me motivation to keep going, and they say, don't worry about it. You know, we get it. We dig it. And it's put together by Rad Rich. Rad Rich is like he's the head honcho there. You know, he's the one who got us in. And it's his radio show, actually. But, you know, he lets us do our thing. So, yeah, that's pretty much what it is. And it's just a bunch of people from Houston, I guess, who've been in the music scene for a long time, who've been doing their thing, and... I'm just lucky to be a part of it, because like I said, Felipe is also a part of it. So these guys that are on the show, they're pretty much like they've been around the Houston music scene since the early 90s, and like with Rad and the 80s, you know. So it I guess I'm the youngest one in the group, but they've accepted me and they appreciate what I'm doing, and I appreciate them having me, so it kind of works, I guess.
What would you say the difference between what you're doing now and what Felipe's doing?
Well, Felipe, I do the Tex-Mex stuff. Felipe does the Pachuco Boogie, and that is a different era. It's Pachuco music, but it's from the 40s. Like he does, it's like the 40s and 50s, and it's like mambo and danzón and cumbia and stuff like that. So it's a different era. Like it's Felipe spins Chicano music. Like you'll hear a lot of Lalo Guerrero and his music, which was I guess he's the pioneer of Chicano music. He's been playing, I mean, some would say he's the pioneer of Chicano music, and he gets credit for being the pioneer of Chicano music. But also, going back to Houston and off the subject, Lydia Mendoza was from the Heights, and she was born in the Heights, which would make her Chicana. And she was playing music in the 20s, putting out records, you know. So, I mean, you know, like I said, some would say Lalo Guerrero is the godfather of Chicano music and the first to do it, maybe because he did it in English. But, you know, so that's what Felipe does. He focuses on that era with the Chicano boogie. That's what the Pachuco boogie, that's what the genre of music is called. And I do the 60s stuff, which is the Chicano soul and the Tex-Mex. Tejano, the music was, it's a mixture of two genres. It's conjunto and the orquestas. Conjunto was what the poor Mexicans were listening to. They would listen to conjunto, like they would have a barn, they'd clean it out and have a dance, and a conjunto band would come and play. And there was this, an accordion, a bajo sexto, and a bass. And orquestas were what the upper-class Mexicans listened to, and it was orchestras. So Tejano, they took both of those, and they mixed them, and in the middle you got Tejano, and it's a mixture of orquestas and conjunto. So basically the conjunto was the lower class, and this is what, I mean, anyone will tell you, conjuntos were what the lower class listened to, orquestas were what the upper class listened to, and Tejano came in when they were the middle class. And so Felipe, like I said, I'm sorry, back to the story, but Felipe does the 40s stuff, and I do the stuff from the 60s, which was, that's the era I feel more of a connection with, and obviously Felipe feels more a connection with the stuff from the 40s. You can tell by his style, his lingo, all that is the Pachuco stuff, which was around in the 40s.
What would you say about playing music that we haven't already covered in this interview?
Playing music?
I mean, playing records, spinning records. I bet it could be about...
Oh, okay, what would I say about... Well, I think with the records, like the actual records that I spin, the reason why I spin records as opposed to on a laptop, I mean, obviously, if you spin on a laptop, you have a lot more access to music, and but these records honestly are what they're the spark that ignited my passion for the music. Like these records to me are a gateway to the past, and I felt a connection to the records, which is why I spin them. Like you know, these records, they have history themselves. You know, I find records with names on them, like Belinda Loves Johnny Forever in 1965, you know. These records were listened to. They helped somebody get through a breakup. They someone listened to them and thought about someone that they loved. Someone listened to them, missed someone who got, you know, passed away in Vietnam. You know, and I feel a connection with these records, and I felt like I shouldn't just have these records put up nicely in a box or on a shelf. Like I want these records to fulfill their purpose, and that's to be played, you know. So that's the main reason why I collect records and I spin them, because I feel that they tell a story and they're a gateway to the past, and they're just you know, my connection to the past, you know. So that's what I could say about records and why I spin records as opposed to anything else, because it would be a lot easier for me to spin CDs or a laptop. But like I said, these records are what got me into this whole mess. But yeah, so that's my look on records and why I spin them as opposed to anything else, because I'm passionate about them because they are a gateway to the past and they tell a story. And they have, you know, there's a lot of history behind these old records. Most of my records are 50 plus years old, and they've been through so much. They've been through, you know, different hands and been put away for years, and now they're back out where they belong, under the needle, making people dance.
Do you find that a lot of the material you have on records has been digitized and available?
Well, there's some of it. Some of it's been digitized, and I've been doing a lot of it, putting a lot of the stuff on myself just so people can hear it and get familiar with it. But there's also tons that has not been put on the internet yet. And once I get around to it, I'm going to start doing that also. I've kind of started slowly, but yeah.
Describe many important moments in your musical career. Which experience has had the biggest impact on you?
Okay, let's see. That's a tough question. It's a good question. I think
it could be more than one too.
Probably when my son was born, because before that it was always just about fun. Like, I played in a band just to have fun and to party and to, you know, to pick up, you know, meet new people and to hang out and have fun. When my son was born, I felt like, well, one, I quit the band that I was playing in and started DJing, and I felt it was my duty to preserve the music, not only for my sake, but for his sake. You know, it's his culture just as well, you know. He's deeply rooted in Houston. And I think my son being born was like a big impact on me and what I thought about I should be known to rep. When I want my son to think about me when he's older, I want him to look back and see what I represented, and I want it to be positive, you know. Not saying the bands I was in weren't positive, but I don't want to just be known for being in those bands. I want him to remember me as being, you know, having a cause, you know. So definitely my son being born was like the biggest impact on me and the direction I took with my music.
Very cool. This has been really great. Is there anything we haven't talked about that you
want to
talk about?
I think we covered everything. Let's see. I think we got everything.
Great.
Cool.
We'll have another chance to talk to you. So, yeah.
Awesome.
Great.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm supposed to say something at the end. Let me do that. This concludes the interview with Isaac Rodriguez. Thank you very much for sharing all of your thoughts and wisdom with us.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you.